criticisms of that Morris made of capitalism was very good, and also the sort of ends he sort of anticipated were very good. But there were, I think, a few contradictions that came up, certainly in quotations to do with his means. And could you say a little bit more about those?
Well, you say a bit more about what
I will, yes. I was thinking sort of especially about whether some of the means that, say, Lenin outlined in, say, his early books, I'm not thinking about the sort of later ones, would have been that far removed from the sort of reality that that Morris dreamed of.
Well, I don't know what early works of Morris of Lenin you're talking about.
Maybe specifically what is to be done.
Well, I think it's entirely different. I mean, in What Is to Be Done, Lenin argued that the working class cannot achieve socialist consciousness. Morris rejected that view. There were a lot of people around the Socialist League at the time who held that view, without any doubt. The growing anarchist wing, which in the 1890s took over the League, certainly held the view that the idea of a conscious revolutionary movement was out of the question. Morris didn't, in fact, hold this view at all, and I don't recall anything in his writings that actually demonstrated that he did hold that view. He argued that until a majority of people wanted and understood, until they were educated, as he put it, into the principles of socialism, you cannot have socialism. About that, he was absolutely right. What he did argue is that spontaneous discontent, whilst it is inevitable under capitalism, doesn't make revolutions. At best, it makes revolts. But then, as he points out, not at best, but in fact at worst. Because all that happens when you have a blind revolt is that, first of all, people don't know where they're going. And secondly, it tends to rally people round to the ruling class, which, of course, is what happens, has been the history of minority insurrectionary movements within capitalism. You recall a few weeks ago in the talk on Bronte O'Brien that after the Newport uprising, the state had the kind of support it needed to more or less smash the Chartists. You only have to remember the Anglian Brigade in the early 70s, which won more support for the government of the day in its law and order programme than any amount of speeches by William Whitelaw would ever win support for anything. That kind of action, sort of alienated from, isolated from the general working class movement, is bound to failure. Morris argued, if you're going to be isolated by circumstances from the general movement of the working class, then the best thing to say is that until the working class actually is with you, until they're going in your direction, there's nothing you can do except continue to put ideas. And that was fundamentally different from Lenin, not only in his later works, but in his early ones.
Yes, I'd like to just add one important point to this question of Lenin and Morris. There is one curious, important analogy between Morris and Lenin, which recent Leninists have grabbed hold of like a drowning man to a straw. And that is this, that, as you are no doubt aware, having seized power in circumstances which Marx and Engels had envisaged and rejected as being a sound base for seizing power, but having so seized power, the Bolsheviks were in a position where they could establish socialism and, in fact, establish state capitalism. But they were nevertheless very dependent upon their tradition of Marxist ideology. And it was very important for them to retain the support and sympathy of large sections of the European and other working class movements for their support of the Russian Revolution. And Lenin was forced to develop a theory of different stages of socialism and communism. The remarkable thing is that prior to Lenin's development of this notion of different levels of socialism and communism, the one being like what they've got in Russia now, the other one being something ultimate, was that very, very few people indeed had ever put forward such a notion prior to that need arising of Lenin to square the reality of the Russian Revolution with Marxist theory. And the only person who had made suggestions of that kind, beyond Marx himself in the Critique of the Gothic Program, was William Morris, who did argue a notion of two stages of society after the revolution. Of course, like Morris in Marx in the Critique of the Gothic Program, it was by no means the justification for the Russian dictatorship that Lenin developed. Nevertheless, a man like Meyer, who wrote a major study, or valuable study of Morris, in recent years in France, which is available in English translation, grabbed hold of this like manna from heaven. Because here was somebody, well before Lenin and the Russian Revolution, who gives at least some plausibility to there being a tradition of this notion of a higher and lower phase of socialism and so on. But Morris did, oddly enough, write something along these lines, which, as I say, makes a curious link with Lenin, though, as with the Critique of the Gothic Program by Marx, is by no means, in fact, saying the same thing.
I'd like to say something about William Morris's mistakes. First of all, the question of violence. I think Steve dealt with that quite adequately in the talk, so there's nothing more that I want to say or want to ask. But there's the question of leadership. Morris did say in print a number of times, as did Marx, that the emancipation of the working class must be the work of the working class itself. But when you read News from Nowhere, it's quite clear that Morris did have some concept of leadership, because he talks about the Labour leaders holding meetings in Trafalgar Square and organising the revolution and that sort of thing. So I'd like Steve to comment on leadership. And also, I'm not sure exactly what Morris's position was on the question of parliamentary democracy. He talked about the parliament being turned into the dung market in a socialist society, but did he think, as we do, that parliament and the other democratic institutions are things which can be used to bring socialism about, or did he think that parliamentary democracy had been a dead loss from start to finish?
Yeah. Well, you see, the trouble is, I'm in an odd position. I've got to disagree with both the chairman and the other speaker, but I don't. You see, therefore, I think they're falling for the mistake which I referred to. That you mustn't take News from Nowhere as being, in any what sense, Morris's description of what will happen. What News from Nowhere is Morris's. News from Nowhere starts off with a description of a socialist going up to the League meeting, and he says there are as many visions of socialism as there were socialists present. And that always happens. And what Morris is trying to do is to take an amalgamation of the various views which are around at the time. Your point about Labour leaders, it's quite true. You've got to be very careful about the word leadership. The SPGB, because it came out of the SDF in the way it did, has got a very strong opposition to the term leadership, the idea of leadership. Morris very often would refer to Labour leaders, socialist leaders, in a way of meaning prominent people within the socialist movement. It's not a very good term. It's a term we would reject, so might. But you know, I wouldn't go on with that. On the point about Morris's... you say you're confused about Morris's attitude to Parliament. Morris himself was confused about this. He changed his mind about it several times. See, what happened was, in the 1890s, after 1893, with the growth of the ILP, Morris began to think that something could be done with local councils and with Parliament. History was maturing his own view of what could be done. In one sense, it was dragging it down as well, because in another sense, it was dragging it further towards reformism. Because after all, let's face it, Parliament and reformism have tended to go hand in hand.
The SPGB is almost a unique exception of an organisation which, on the one hand, sees value in the use of Parliament, and on the other hand, rejects reformism. Almost anyone else who ever talks about the value of Parliament wants to get in there to run capitalism. So it's a difficult political sort of paradox. But the point about it is, Morris's attitude towards Parliament was an irreverent one. Mm. He saw Parliament as being something which was, at the very most, it was the door at the end of a road to socialism. People talk about the parliamentary road to socialism. I find it an extremely unpleasant vision of what a socialist revolution could be like. Because the parliamentary road to socialism means that the work of bringing about socialism is done in Parliament somehow. I think that it's far more realistic to talk about the door at the end of the road, the place that you arrive at, Parliament being used as a means once you've got a majority of people who understand what socialism is. And what Morris was saying was that whereas the Fabians and the various reformists on the left in his day were arguing that, look, it's hopeless to get the workers to understand anything, to make a revolution for themselves, what you've got to do is at best win their votes off them, get into Parliament, do it for them. Morris argued it's got to be done, you know, amongst the working class itself. There's got to be consciousness, there's got to be organisation. And then he varied from time to time, although it must be said that in the 1890s he did hold this view that Parliament can be used. And he made a very perceptive comment, which you read, that it's much easier to get a revolution through the ballot box than to go out and fight. Why go and fight when people can use the power they've got to gain access to the state and turn the state into an instrument of emancipation rather than an agent of oppression? And Morris's argument, of course, at the time was that, similar to the one which was put forward by a speaker for the SPGB in the early days of this organisation, when he said, if the workers aren't going to vote for it, they're certainly not going to bloody fight for it. And in a sense, that's right. If socialism is something that workers want, then that can be, the ballot box can be used, it can be made use of, and there can be access to the state machine turning that as a power not against the working class, but against the power of capital. And William Morris was confused on it. What's much more important is that we're not confused on it, and therefore, as in the case of Marx, political respect for a thinker doesn't mean respect for those areas about which he was confused, but respect for those areas about which he was clear on Parliament was one of them. As for turning Parliament into a dung heap in a socialist society, because Morris was in that sense prophetic, because here we are in 1983, in a capitalist society, it already happened.
Right. Further contribution.
On the last point, which the speaker tried to explain to us how there was no confusion on the part of the SPGB as to how Parliament could be used for the benefit of emancipation of the working class, to me it seemed to cause more confusion, because I don't understand how this party can be any different from any other brand of leftist party that tries to use Parliament. I'd like to hear some sort of clarification of the difference between this party's road to socialism. If socialism is anything to do with voting, you know, if it's what socialism has to do with abdicating responsibility on one hand, and on the other hand, as Morris would say, people taking responsibility and making decisions about their own destiny seems to me irreconcilable.
Mm-hmm. Well, Parliament at the moment is a means whereby those who have power can direct the government and armed forces to defend that power. And something like every 5 years, we are given the opportunity to go into a ballot box and vote them back into power to carry on running capitalism. Now, what is the difference between us and every other party? Every other party wants to do that. They want to become leaders, elected into Parliament, to run affairs on behalf of other people, as representatives, as leaders. Now, we would argue that Parliament represents a power. Parliament as an institution doesn't necessarily have any particular magical qualities. But Parliament represents something. It represents the coercive powers of society, it represents the arms in society, it represents the laws which are passed. And all of those things are running in interest of a minority and have been for hundreds of years. Now, what we're saying is that we have the vote. Every one of us has a vote. What has socialism got to do with voting? Voting is a barometer of whether or not you've got a majority or not. We put out a candidate in the last election in Islington South. We got about 90 votes. That's a bloody good barometer. We found out that, you know, the revolution's not going to happen in 1952. So that's a way of knowing. It's a way of knowing. It's a way of your best friends telling you in secrecy what they think of your ideas. So we found out the majority of you don't want a socialist revolution. Now, following on from that, we say what you have to do is put up people, not incidentally to go as leaders into Parliament, not to go as representatives on behalf of other people, but to simply act as delegates, to simply go and do what the majority of people want them to do, which is to take away those powers of coercion from the minority who have them, and to put those powers into the hands of the majority in order to ensure that when a majority of people want a different society, the minority is not able to say, well, you can't have it. You can't have those factories. You can't have those docks. You can't have those mines. They belong to us. Now, what socialists want to do with Parliament is to pass one single act. An act of Parliament saying, all of the earth does not belong to you. It belongs to all of us, the whole society. Now, once that is passed, what is a capitalist minority going to do? Leave power in their hands in Parliament. They can do a lot. They can pass laws and say, the majority might want socialism. We're not letting you have it. We control the armed forces. We control production at all different levels. We control road transport. Once a majority has used that power to go into Parliament, sending delegates accountable to that majority to do precisely what it tells it to do, that is using that power in order to enact what the majority wants, in order to dispossess the minority of their power of ownership and control and put it in the hands of the whole community. And nobody will be able to stop that from happening. Nobody's got the power to prevent a majority taking political power to itself from using that political power in its own interest. Now, what are the alternatives to that? The alternatives to that is that you get a majority of socialists, but you say Parliament doesn't matter. So you leave the armed forces, you leave Parliament, you leave the local councils in control of Tories, Labour parties, Communist parties, whoever it may be, organisations that want to lead people and want to run capitalism. Now, we would argue that that is a foolish and a counterproductive point of view. Obviously, if you want to gain control of society, you've got to get political power in that society and the opportunity to direct the way in which that society operates. And that seems to be fundamentally different from what anyone else says about Parliament. Everyone else says send leaders into Parliament. We're talking about delegates. Everyone else says use Parliament in order to nationalise things. Put things under the control of Parliament, under the control of the state. We're saying don't put it under the control of Parliament or the state, but under the control of the whole community, which won't have any need for Parliament at all once it has dispossessed that minority. So, well, do you see the difference now?
Yes. Yes. I'm confused about Morris's position on the future ways of managing society. I mean, if we abolish the capitalist system, then it would appear that we will have two choices. I mean, this is my understanding of socialist tradition would suggest. One is what we have in the Soviet Union now, which is central or centralization of capital and management through bureaucracy, hopefully till the time is ripe when
the whole world can socialist, and then we don't need the machinery of war, police, etc., etc. Then we have also a Marxist tradition which emanates from Marx's writing on the Paris Commune through direct control of the means of production, management, etc., by the workers themselves. It seems to me there is a contradiction between the decentralized picture of the Paris Commune and the necessities also of centralization, which I got that you have your party take some different position on. What I'm interested in is to know how Morris formulated a way out of this paradox.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. First of all, incidentally, capitalism simply means a society based upon capital. A society which is not capitalist is not based upon capital. So to talk in the one breath about Russia or the Soviet Union, and in the other breath to talk about centralisation of capital, and to suggest that Russia has gone beyond capitalism, is of course a contradiction. That's not in fact what's happened at all. Russia is a capitalist society, and what exists in Russia is a society where there is an extremely centralised control of capital by a state bureaucracy, instead of a more diffused ownership of capital by shareholders, as happens in Western so-called private capitalism. So Russia as a post-capitalist model is simply a myth. On the point about how Morris saw the remedy between the problem of centralisation and decentralisation, Morris in News from Nowhere, bearing in mind what I've already said, that News from Nowhere is by no means a blueprint and by no means a certain portrait of how socialism must be, Morris spoke about the extreme decentralisation of society, the breaking down of society into very, very small communes, communal controls, municipal control over localised production. Frankly, not only is it something that I don't find greatly appealing, but from a point of view of the possible economic management of a highly industrialised world society, I would... Well, certainly throw open the challenge to anyone to argue with what I'm about to say, but I would say it's an economic nonsense. It couldn't possibly happen. I think Morris was profoundly wrong in that vision. What Morris saw was this small autonomous community, these small autonomous communities. It seems to me that the organisation of production for use on a world basis, as we are now in a highly industrialised society, where the whole of the world is being envisaged as an economic unit, the only way in which control can operate is neither on a highly centralised, single worldwide basis or on a purely localised, communal basis. Quite clearly, there has to be an integration of control between various levels of community so that some decisions have to be made on a world basis. But on the other hand, you know, if Alec wants to paint the walls pink in a... He's a landlord of the pub, incidentally. In a socialist society. Not that he would be the landlord of the pub in a socialist society, but let's assume he's still pulling the drinks downstairs. And he wants to come up here and paint the walls green. We're not going to need to get all of the computer mechanisms worldwide working on it so that people all over the world have to make a decision. That would be clearly nonsensical. Obviously, that seems to be a very local decision, which can be made by people on a much more localised basis. There are other things that have to be decided on a much more worldwide basis. For example, the decision about the production of foodstuffs, which are needed by people all over the world, wheat production and so on, whether seeds are going to be used... whether seas are going to be utilised for certain kinds of deep sea fishing or for certain kinds of, the production of oil or whatever. This is all going to have to be decided on a worldwide basis. But bear in mind one thing. Morris had an almost anti-technological conception of control. Morris saw control in almost primitive primitively human terms. In other words, he tended to see the way in which communal decision-making would take place, almost in the sense of a group of people standing around in the centre of a local rural area and deciding amongst themselves. Clearly, in an age where we now have press-button decision-making facilities, where you could pretty well put cable televisions and computer feedback systems into every single person's home or the places where people happen to reside, quite obviously, in that kind of a situation, the utilisation of that technology in order to make democracy really work, in order to allow every person to have a say on decisions which are likely to affect them or even those which are not, that is now something which is possible. And it seems that we have to be applying our vision of democracy in a socialist society, not to centralised state capitalist dictatorships like Russia, and not to 19th century semi-rural conceptions of decision-making like Morris, but in fact to worldwide democratic planning on the, with the utilisation of local and worldwide integrated computer decision-making processes.
I would say myself at this stage that it would be unfair, and we don't make that criticism, Morris, but to criticise Morris for not being an SPGB, a supporters party. It was hard for him to do, having died a few years, 8 years, was it? It was, 7 or 8 years, I thought, before we came into existence. But what should usefully be remembered is that he and we both came out of the same organisation. The sort of reasons he came out of it before us were very similar to the reasons we came out of it. But it was the formation of this party, the Socialist Party of Great Britain, from dissidents of the Social Democratic Federation, which, and we don't, I don't think we in this party normally have got an exaggerated sense of our importance or contributions to working class history. But in this sense, I think we can use claim that the creation of the Socialist Party of Great Britain did make at least one original contribution to a body of thought that in other respects we are merely the heirs of, that we carry on many concepts and traditions which Marx and Engels and the working class movement before us had ready-made for us. But in this sense, the creation and foundation of the Socialist Party made a fresh contribution which resolved the dilemma of which Morris, if you like, was one of the last people to face without a resolution being available. Throughout the 19th century, socialists, people claiming to be socialists, were divided between the revolutionaries and the reformists. And part of the point that has been made about the difficulty Morris had in relation to the question of Parliament was precisely because, for practical purposes, and up till the formation of this party in 1904, anybody who proposed entry into Parliament did so on the assumption that whatever the objective of the socialist concern might be, the basis on which they would enter Parliament would be on a list of promises of a reform nature. And that certainly was what the Social Democratic Federation, when it stood in Parliament, did. It offered a list of reform promises. And the revolutionaries, who saw that capitalism couldn't be turned into something other than it was, couldn't be made into a society which could serve the interests in any way of the working class. The revolutionaries, in rejecting reforms, rejected Parliament because they only saw that as a possibility of entering on a basis of reform promises. The only people who did enter Parliament were people with reform promises, and since then they have been the only people who have entered Parliament. So we can hardly blame Morris for being so near and yet not having yet arrived at the resolution of a dilemma that only the formation of this party, in fact, in my submission, did resolve. He was confused by it because that was our original contribution to working class thought, that it was both necessary to enter Parliament, which, as Stephen said, is the place in which capitalist control is exercised, but enter it on a basis different from everybody else who has ever entered it, namely with a mandate for socialism, and not on the basis of a reform programme. That is the feature which was an innovation by the foundation of this party.
Yes.
How did he handle the wealthy inherited?
How did Morris?
Yes.
Well, two or three things I can say about that. First of all, of course, as you know, Morris's work was involved in design, in printing. In fact, during the last years of his life, the final project he was engaged in was a printing of a new version of the works of Chaucer. Also, of course, the study of and the printing of ancient literature. He, in doing that, ran a printing press, which he started up, and by all accounts, I don't particularly know, the chairman no doubt will, the detailed biographical details of this, but by all accounts was one of those capitalist employers who, because of his principles, found himself in a position where, and also not only because of his principles but because he was so extremely wealthy, found himself in a position where he was actually able to pay much higher wages than anyone else paid and to run the place that he had in a manner which was quite suitable to himself. In other words, very often, if a very rich lady came to Morris and asked him to design something for him or to sell him something, and Morris thought she wouldn't appreciate it, he refused to sell it to her. He refused to do the job. And he said, I want to work for people who will appreciate art. That's, of course, a very nice position to be in. It's not a position, somebody goes into a second-hand car showroom and they think that the workers of British Labour are lazy. You can't refuse to sell them a car. So, in that sense, he was in a very fortunate position. He was apparently somebody who had such a comfortable upbringing that he was, in fact, in a position where he could be fairly unconcerned about his own wealth. He had a reasonably guaranteed income for all of his life. Although, when the SDF Journal Justice was started up, he put a lot of money into it. The money for Justice was actually, the press was originally paid for by Edward Carpenter, who didn't, in fact, get involved with the SDF. He went off to do other things like vegetarianism and so on. But Morris got involved in that, and he put a great deal of money in it, and he paid for the publication of Justice, even though it was running at a loss. And when Commonweal started coming out, Morris was actually not able to give as much money to that as he wanted to, because he was spending a great deal of money on financing Justice, and the amount of money he had for political activities was running out. But, I mean, Morris did write quite extensively about the position of a man in the capitalist class being a supporter of socialism. Of course, you may remember, if you've read it, that Marx writes in the Communist Manifesto that the nearer socialism comes, the more it becomes a threat to the capitalist class, the more some sections of the capitalist class will come over to socialism. And to some extent, in his earliest attachment to the idea of socialism, there is some hint of that in Morris. In other words, some of the capitalists who got involved with the SDF came more in fear than hope. And there was some sense of sort of thinking that it was better to be with the going in the direction of the waves than opposing them. I wouldn't for a moment suggest that was in any way Morris's principal reason for getting involved. Another one was that Morris was wealthy enough to be able to afford that very expensive luxury called morality. And therefore, when Morris first got involved in politics, he was able to take a kind of fairly observant view of politics. It wasn't something that greatly involved him. The poverty he wrote about wasn't something he knew much about. In fact, he wrote in 1888 that although he'd seen poor people in the streets, he'd never actually been into a slum house. He'd only ever seen them from the outside. He wrote that whenever he saw a drunk in the street, it made him feel ashamed and couldn't work for half a day on his design and so on. This might sound to some of us here like kind of, rather pious capitalist class morality. It doesn't actually sound like that to me. It sounds to me like I'd rather, far rather have that kind of pious capitalist class morality than the usual brand, which is all too common. And also, of course, in his early writings, Morris addressed his own class, which incidentally he referred to as the middle class, because in those days the capitalist class was still distinguished from the aristocracy, called itself that it was the middle class and referred to as such. And in his early writings, in the early 1880s, Morris was still writing to other members of the middle class and saying, look, if we don't do something ourselves in order to help the condition of the majority of people, then the majority of people are going to do it anyway. And he sort of wrote warnings to the class of which he was a part about what was likely to happen. When he got no response, he wrote his first ever, before he joined the SDF in 1882, his first ever, what might be called, socialist article was addressed actually at the top of the page to the working class of Britain. And at the underneath that, he said, look, the middle class are the strongest, the most ferocious, the most uncaring class that's ever been. I can tell you I'm one of them. I can tell you, because I've tried arguing your case to them. And believe me, you won't get any change out of there. And that convinced him. It convinced him. His period as a radical and as a liberal, trying to convince his own class, taught him a good few lessons. Another thing is, powerful though Morris was, and respected though he was, I mean, there was even some talk of giving him the poet laureateship at one point. As soon as Gladstone found out that he had, you know, nasty communist views, they soon made sure he didn't get that. And he also, incidentally, when he was about to be offered it, he wrote a letter to his friend Burne Jones saying, imagine that, a socialist at the court of Queen Victoria. Saying poems to her, the kind, you know, you imagine him standing there reading the Pilgrims of Hope to Queen Victoria. You know, she didn't know what a lesbian was. She certainly wouldn't know what a socialist was. And so there was a problem there. And the other thing about Morris, despite all of his wealth, he was tremendously attacked. The press crucified Morris. They wrote the most disgusting things about him. And even after he died, Morris had a terrible time. I mean, the man who wrote Morris's biography, McHale, wrote the biography of this pleasant, wealthy poet who had these odd socialist views, but don't take much notice of them. And people, even to this day, you know, they don't like the idea of a talented, able person, cultured in capitalist terms, who was a socialist. And they can't stand this, and therefore they're constantly trying to say, oh well, Morris changed his mind before he died, and in the mid-1890s, he died in 1895, he changed his mind and he was he was all right again. And people keep finding these bits of correspondence, and in 1894 an American wrote to him and he said, I've read in the London Times that you've given up these socialist ideas, good to hear it, now come back and join the club. And there's a letter from Morris saying, I have not given up my socialist ideas, in fact I believe them more strongly now than I have. This infuriates people, but Morris stuck with it to the end. And in fact he had a hard time of it. From, you know, there's nothing the ruling class like less than a worker who's a socialist than one of their own ranks who starts to get these sort of funny ideas.
You spoke before when you were talking about socialist alternative about the confusion between his literary works and his theoretical suggestions. How much sort of discontinuity was there between those two sets of ideas? And why did he actually go in for making statements about practical application? What was his actual motivation for it? Was it just to create more discussion?
Well, on the second question, I'm not entirely sure why Morris wrote News from Nowhere is a good question. Partly, I'll tell you why. Morris read a book. Well, there were two books that greatly upset Morris. One was called After London, which was a description of a future society. Another one which upset him even more, and it upset you even more if you read it, by Edward Bellamy, called, that book that you've read something else by, which he didn't in fact write. I think R.H. Tawney wrote what you're talking about, but anyway. But anyway, we can argue about that another time. But the point about it is that he read this book by Bellamy called Looking Backward. And in Looking Backward, Bellamy spoke about this socialist society where the state controlled everything. Everyone had to go and present vouchers to the state machine telling them how many hours a day they were. And Morris was horrified about this. He thought, yeah, this is a perversion of socialism, a distortion. And therefore, that's one of the reasons he wrote News from Nowhere. I think he was trying to say, here's another way of looking at it. But I don't think any more than that. I think it was a way of looking at it, no more. But your other point is a very good one. I won't go into it at length, but just to say that you're quite right, there's a big discontinuity between Morris's political essays and News from Nowhere. And I entirely agree with E.P. Thompson, who wrote in his second edition of his biography of Morris, that Morris should not be judged on the basis of News from Nowhere. It's a good enough book to be judged on. It's a very well worth reading novel and presents a lot of good ideas. But Morris's political writing, if you read some of his works like A Factory as It Might Be, Useful Work versus Useless Toil, How We Live Now and How We Might Live, The Society of the Future, The Hope of Civilization, these works by Morris were outstanding works. And they're readable. They're readable. I mean, they're much more readable than I am listenable to. They really are very, very well worth reading. Because Morris is capable of expressing, in a very, very simple way, ideas about new ways of living, which a lot of people otherwise found very worrying and frightening, because people are afraid of what is new. And I think his political writings are certainly much more important than his literary work. And incidentally, just to put in a word for one other literary work by Morris, apart from News from Nowhere, and that's A Dream of John Ball. Certainly don't forget that, because that's one well worth reading to get another aspect of the broad vision of Morris. But let me just say one other thing about this discontinuity between Morris's News from Nowhere and his political work. It's a little bit personal, but I'll tell you. I wrote a letter about 3 years ago to the people who set the university. There's a university paper called The History of Political Ideas, where they study all kinds of people who thought up different ways of oppressing people. You know, everyone from Plato to NATO, they've got them down there. And I, because I'm associated with that particular course, I said, why don't we put onto that course the political writings of Morris? Got a letter back about 1 year later from, you know, a highly paid intellectual. It took him a year to think of the right words and put in the letter. And he said, we can't have novels on the political ideas, the political ideas paper. Well, as a matter of fact, you know, most of it's, of course, sheer invention on the political ideas paper, but that's another matter. So I wrote back and said, Morris didn't only write a novel. He wrote a number of very important political essays, very interesting for students to read, give them an idea of another aspect of socialism, you know, apart from the oppressive dictatorial one that we all know and love. Have another look at another side of socialism. And of course, this has gone on for 3 years, and at the moment, I think I'm just about, you know, at the position where they've realised I wasn't writing about William Shakespeare or something. It's got to the point where they just looked him up in the index in the back of the book of political figures and found out who he was. But it's a very, very hard thing. And actually, getting somebody's ideas recognised in this society is extremely hard. It's extremely hard to actually be taken as being serious. It's been Morris's biggest problem. Nobody took him seriously. It's very hard. Now, maybe if there was Channel 4 in his day, they would have given him 15 minutes every 2 weeks. But as it is, nobody took it very seriously. And socialist ideas are taken seriously. And I suppose the final thing to say about Morris's vision of socialism is that if you've got a vision of socialism which isn't dictatorial, isn't oppressive, isn't based upon a government pushing people around, then certainly don't write a book about it, because it certainly won't sell.
I'm trying to
So half a minute to mildly differ with one important point. I don't know to what extent Kira, in Arthur referring to discontinuity, real or imagined, was in fact specifically referring to the vision Morris suggested might be that of the change of socialism in as outlined in News from Nowhere, and contrary views he stated in some of his essays. What I thought you might have been referring to, and certainly other people have, is a discontinuity between his literary and artistic output and his socialist ideas. Now, this has certainly been strongly suggested by many people. His original biographer, Macaulay, as Stephen has said, certainly greatly admired his literary and artistic output and was embarrassed about what he saw as the discontinuity with socialist ideas. But to me, they're all of a piece. It's worth remembering that this well-to-do young man went up to Oxford. Not as a socialist, it was not until he was years into experience and adult work that he became a socialist.
Before he died.
Right, 12 years before he died, he packed a lot into those 12 years as a socialist. But for the many years before he was a socialist, he was involved in one of the major art movements in this country, the Pre-Raphaelites. And the point about the Pre-Raphaelites was, they called themselves Pre-Raphaelites. They were a group of artists who felt that the artist Raphael, the embodiment of the Renaissance, the embodiment of the rise, the society, the art, the social change, which in fact was the social change of the rise of capitalism and the end of feudal society, and its expression in artistic terms was symbolized to them by Raphael, that in rejecting Raphael and calling themselves pre-Raphaelites, they were referring to a form of art, real or imagined, which they saw as ended by the rise of capitalist individualism. Individualism as against a notion, real or imagined, of feudalism and society as it should be, where people are an integrated community, and which they saw capitalism as destroying, was the purpose of their calling themselves Pre-Raphaelites, an artistic movement. Now, people taken up with that movement, which became a criticism of capitalism and what capitalism did for people, in artistic terms, hived off in different directions. The modern Catholic Church of Britain, of course, derives very much from Cardinal Newman, who was part in the Oxford movement of precisely a similarly sensitive and well-to-do people who were outraged by the individual selfishness and go-gettism of capitalism and look back, as the Pre-Raphaelites did as artists, to a medieval Catholic-shaped world where, real or imagined, there was this community broken down by capitalist individualism. So there were different movements out of that movement that could be taken or were taken, and some people did move beyond that. The point about Morris was, and this is the continuity I see in his artistic work, initially as an artist, as a painter, as a stained glass maker, as a translator of the Icelandic sagas and of Norse poetry sagas, he saw capitalism breaking down certain values that he felt should be restored. It was in socialism, later in his life, that he saw the resolution of this problem. How could the individual selfishness and opportunism of capitalist society be replaced by a sense of community and joint responsibility and creativity? And for him, rightly so, I would say, he saw it resolved by the concept of socialism. So, if anyone, Kira or not, sees, and certainly his original biographer and all sorts of his apologists and admirers, do see a discontinuity between his artistic endeavours and his socialist ideas. On the contrary, the socialist ideas were his way of resolving the dilemma posed by the pre-Raphaelite artistic movement.